Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Jim Bianco and Ira Harris, and a very special treat. We have a number of invited participants that will be asking questions and engaging in the discussion. Jim is president of Bianco Research. Since November 1990, he's been producing fixed income commentaries with a circulation of hundreds of portfolio managers and traders. He's regularly featured on Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Barron's, Business Week, Forbes, Fortune, CNBC, CNN, Bloomberg, and Fox News. And Ira's hedge fund manager, a global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Richard. This is really quite a treat. And Jim, thank you and everybody who's here. I mean, this is a very nice group. And I know there's other people who will access this, but we've never done this. So this will be interesting. And Peter Buchvar, who could easily be sitting in here and probably will shortly, could easily be part of this. So thank you, Richard, for making this possible.
Great. Just as a listing of the attendees, the participants, we have Alexandra Harris, Angelo Gallo, Marianne Moreau, Gidon Cohen, John Crowley, Kevin McCarthy, Bruce Light. Did I miss anybody? Okay, great. I thought we'd begin with a discussion, Jim, on your macro view of the economy and the financial markets. How do you see that situation for a general discussion just to begin with?
I think the biggest question is the one that we're all sick of talking about because it matters so much. Is the inflation surge persistent? I like to use that word over permanent because nothing in life is permanent. Or is it transitory? And I'm in the camp that it is persistent. I'm in the camp that what is driving this inflation surge is excess demand. It's not a supply problem. It is that we stuffed everybody full of stimulus money, and we also didn't spend a lot during the lockdowns. Coming out of the lockdowns, we're roaring ahead with our spending. And the problem with the production side of the economy and the supply chain side of the economy is it can't run as fast as we want it to. As I've liked to say, as far as the supply chain goes, I know the consensus view is to ignore it. It will be a glut by summer. But if you dig into the supply chain stuff, and I have a little bit, we can talk about that later. The basic problem is it's running at 100% of capacity. And it's not going to run at 103% of capacity next month. Now, the only way to bring it back into balance is higher prices. It kills off demand and then brings it back down. And so, therefore, I think we're going to continue to see higher prices as we move forward. And these higher prices, in my mind, the transitory story is already wrong. No one in the transitory camp 6 or 8 months ago ever envisioned a six handle on inflation. So they're already wrong in that regard. And I think that as we continue to move forward, prices are going to stay elevated as well, too. Interest rates is interesting because where this is showing up in interest rates is where no one expected it to show up. And that is we're getting a giant surge of interest rates on the front end of the yield curve. Now, the front end of the yield curve was supposed to be controlled by the Federal Reserve or any central bank, if you want to talk globally. They're supposed to do forward guidance. They're supposed to tell you when they're going to raise rates. So there's no fear of, you know, the front end getting away from us. Well, that's exactly what's happening, starting in Australia when they had to give up yield curve control because it blew up in their face about a month ago. And it seems to be surging here through the U.S. right now. We're at, you know, new 21-month highs in two-year note rates. The marketplace is pricing in three rate hikes for next year, three. The first one could come as early as May. It's got a 49% probability that it's going to be in May. If you ask anybody on Wall Street, they will flat out tell you that's wrong. Fed's not going to move that fast. Well, it's the market sending you a signal that inflation is more persistent than we think. Now, it's 2021. If you say anything that is perceived as not positive, you always get the same answer. You're wrong, because yesterday the S&P made a new high, because nothing bearish can happen if the S&P is making new highs. By the way, nothing bullish could happen if the S&P is falling as well too. But that's a different animal unto itself. And I do think that the concern I have on the macro environment is that inflation is more persistent. It's leading to higher short rates. Those higher short rates are giving the dollar carry, and you're starting to see a bid in the dollar. And I don't see those trends reversing anytime soon.
And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, Jim is being kind, because him and actually two people were sitting here, I think it was probably 14, 15 months ago. Jim, Peter, and I did a podcast with you, Richard, and Jim and Peter were both pretty adamant that we were going to see a supply shock, which would lead to higher prices. Now, I saw it more as a demand situation because of the huge amount of money, but they proved very right. But the question that I continued to raise all last year was, what would happen if we saw, well, when we did that, the unemployment rate was probably about 10.5% or so. And we figured it would fall and fall fairly rapidly once the pandemic started to ease a little bit. But the question was, what would the Fed do if we had 6% unemployment and 5% or 6% inflation? Would the Fed move to tighten the monetary situation? And I thought, and the question was really easily answered, of course, no, because unemployment was going to be the far bigger issue, because Chair Powell kept raising, the issue, as he used it, his phrase, over and over again, for those who lost jobs through no fault of their own, that the Fed would err and allow inflation to run hotter. And then we saw at Jackson Hole of August 2020, that they came out with the flexible, adjustable inflation target, right? Which now they've been taken to task for, which was, we're going to run hotter. We'll let inflation run hotter for longer. So they find it have been in this situation. But I think Jim's point is really the right point, because we're in a difficult situation, because they don't even understand why the curve, and I'm 530, 210, has flattened as dramatically as it has, right into the face of all this inflation. Historically, we would have seen when the bond market was allowed to trade, and we had the proverbial bond vigilantes, they would be putting a lot of upward pressure on the longer end of the curve, which would, of course, then move, cause the Fed to move, and we would get the classic business cycle type of recession, because the Fed would have to move more aggressively. They're not doing anything of the sort. And this is where we lie here in the market, and Jim says the market's anticipating three. Well, that will have to, that implies that they're going to pull back, because Powell, again, I'm quoting Powell, we're not going to move. We're not going to think about raising rates until we finish the quantitative easing, which is tapering, which by my calendar finishes in July, unless they move to speed it up or move dramatically. But that raises other issues. And I think we've seen it recently, because that affects the dollar. If the Fed moves unilaterally, of the big banks, I'm not talking, I understand what Australia has done, and I understand New Zealand, I understand Canada, Bank of England, we're not sure where they're going, but between the Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank, and the Fed, if the Fed moves unilaterally, the dollar will rally, as we've seen. I mean, we've seen since the October 28th ECB meeting, we've seen the dollar rally 3.5% against the euro, maybe a little bit more. Today was down a tad, but that creates all kinds of problems for the world, because this is not a trade issue anymore, right? Trade is outside of the Chinese trade numbers. I don't think anybody even talks about trade. This is an issue of debt, and the debt by the Institute of International Finance numbers has grown very dramatically. The last numbers I've saw, they actually stayed the same for the third quarter, about 296 trillion. That's 296 trillion, which had grown 10% in the second quarter from 270 to 296. So these are substantial issues. And it's not that it's all dollar debt, of course, but the Fed has been so loose for so long that the world has used the dollar as a major funding currency on top of its regular role as a reserve currency. So there's an issue if the dollar rallies too dramatically, that there are going to be a lot of non-US domiciled companies who are borrowed in debt who are going to have a severe problem. So I guess we're going to go from there.
Peter, you had some related questions that you'd like to ask in terms of Fed tightening and rates and what the ECB could do in 2022. Go ahead.
Sure. To both what Ira and Jim said, Ira, to the point of the Fed's not raising rates until QE is done, and Jim highlighting that the bond market's already beginning to price in a May rate hike, separating what the Fed should do from what they will do, do you guys think that the Fed will speed up the pace of their taper from $15 billion a month?
I'll go first, and I'll say it's a done deal. I think when Governor Waller came out last week and said that they think he should speed it up, Raphael Bostic said that they should speed it up. Jim Bullard said he's open to speeding it up. Rich Clarida said he's open to speeding it up. We've got one of two options that are going to come in December. Either the Fed's going to have to speed it up, and just so we're all on the same page, the Fed announced that they would taper $15 billion a month in November and December. So they have to make a decision about what they want to do in January and or February at the next meeting. And so there has to be a vote on this. So they can't just do nothing. Given what Governor Waller said, I suspect they're either going to speed up the taper or he's going to be the first governor in 16 years to dissent. What I'm trying to say is I think it's a done deal. I think they're going to move from $15 billion a month to $20 billion a month at the December 15th meeting. If they do that, that gets them on pace to be done in time to raise rates in May, if that's what they want to do. Market right now, I just looked, is put a 49% chance that there's going to be a rate hike in May. It's got about a 65% chance that there's going to be a rate hike in June.
And Ira? Your thoughts?
Well, Jim is right on what everybody said last week, but now I have to wait for the December meeting, because it's been an interesting that there's been no dissents, right? There's never a dissent, and then the meeting's over, and then when the Fed speakers go out wherever they go, we got Kaplan and Rosengren going, so. Those are a lot less interviews than we saw before. But when they do go out, it's hard to believe that there was no dissent at the meeting, right? I mean, because they speak a whole different... I listened to Powell's press conference, and I know that the vote's unanimous. And then I listen to these speakers, and I go, where were you at the meeting? You were a voter, and yet nobody voted in the negative. So I find that interesting. And they come out and they talk, but I think Jim's right from what they say, but they better get a G7 meeting together. And part of that issue is you look at the European rates, and I'm sitting looking at them now, and I have somebody who brought this to my attention today, Alexandra, who's on this, right, that Zoltan Pozsar put out a piece today about Europe. And in Europe, which does not have a reverse repo facility, interestingly, because they don't have a prime dealer market, so they're totally structured. But there's a shortage of two-year notes. in Europe. It's so much so that the French effective two-year yield today was negative 80 basis points. I'll say that again, negative 80 basis points. Germany was an effective 73 shots. The shots was an effective negative 73 with an inflation rate that certainly is equal to the U.S. So this whole system is so badly broken. And I think that I'm pretty sure that if they were to taper faster, because then the market would have, by what Powell said and what following up with Jim said, that means that they would raise earlier than initially anticipated. Well, if they raise faster than at a faster pace than anticipated, the dollar is going to go bid. So the G7, and that's what I keep coming back to, the G7 needs to reach an agreement that they all need to taper together. Because if they all taper together tomorrow, it would actually restore some market sanity. And then we could actually look at things and go, okay, let me take a look at how I can value that. Well, am I anticipating that the Fed's going to raise rates, or I could at least move? But right now, the markets are locked into a situation where they can't, there's no room for signals. They've broken it. And they have to own this. And the first step would be if they all tapered together.
And a question from Mary Ann on oil reserves. Will opening oil reserves have any impact on gas prices? And also,
I live out in California, and it's over $5 a gallon out here, guys. So when you fill up your tanks, think about me. Is this going to do anything for the prices opening up these oil reserves?
I guess I'll start, and I'll say no. And I'll say no for the following reason. First of all, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, all of them worldwide, are kind of useless. I mean, what they are is we spent a lot of money buying Middle Eastern oil. We put it on a boat. We brought it to the United States, and we filled a salt cavern. What we did was we made a very environmentally unsound man-made oil field, is what it is. When they say that they're going to take 50 million barrels out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, that's zero sum. It has to go back in. Somewhere down the line, you're going to have to refill what you took out. So it's going to always be zero sum. You'd be better off, and I'll use this because it's political, taking ANWR, the Alaska National Wildlife Reserve, putting a big pipeline from ANWR down to the United States and call that the SPR. Because at least then when you take 50 million barrels out, you don't have to put it back in. You know, it's a permanent increase in supply. What they're hoping for is that by shoving more oil into the system and depressing the price, that later on when the price is lower, they can refill it. Well, good luck with that argument. I mean, now the government's going to be in Wall Street's business trying to predict the price of crude oil. And pretty much everybody I know that tries to predict the price of crude oil doesn't do a very good job of it. And least of all, the White House is going to, you know, I don't hold out hope that they're going to do any better of a job. So it's a zero-sum game, the SPR. We'll see. If there's one thing that they could do for you in California, you're paying $1.50. You're paying $1.50 a gallon in taxes. There, you want to lower the price. You could start right there by tomorrow morning. Cut that in half. 75 cents or something like that. But of course, that's the last thing that they'll want to do. So keep in mind that if the price of crude oil went to zero, you're still going to pay $1.50 a gallon. You actually pay a little bit more because there'll still be a processing fee on top of that too, to turn the crude oil into gasoline.
And Peters, I know, is going to speak to this because he wrote something about it this morning. But I did a radio hit last Tuesday with Joan Esposito in Chicago, and she asked me a question, and it's certainly the show itself is. It's political, and I don't speak to the politics, but she asked me about, because she just wants my financial views, and she asked me about the SPR, and she was gleeful about it. And I said, it's a gigantic mistake, because what's going to happen, they're going to release the oil, there's only so many people who can refine that oil, right? The oil is worth nothing. It has to be refined. So the refiner, who's going to refine it? The big refiners, they'll get a windfall profit. And that's what the headlines will read in certain other places, because the prices will only drop minimus. It's a total headline grab. And she was shocked when I said that. But that's what this is. Look at, they announced it today, right? They've been doing it anyway. There's already been some drawdowns. I think 3 million in the previous weeks. Angelo's on here, so he knows what the number is. They've been drawing down, but you got the headline 50 million, and the oil, crude oil, was $1 lower one time and wound up closing $2 higher. So this, the markets already said, okay, we got that. And it's such a short-term effect what they want. You know, it's a classic political case where politicians always get themselves in trouble because they have to appear as if they're doing something. Right. You got to do something. You know, as I always made fun of Bernanke's book, The Courage to Act. But after he did QE1, I thought the courage was not to act. But we have a difference of opinion there, and it's still playing out.
You know, if I could throw one more thing in there about this, what's going on with the price of crude oil? And this might be a topic that'll come up a little bit more in this discussion. If you look at the Transportation Department, they do measure a statistic called vehicles miles traveled. How many miles do all the cars in the United States accumulate in a month? We're back to driving our cars to pre-pandemic levels. $290 billion in September was the last number. So we're all the way back to pre-pandemic. Gasoline demand from the Department of Energy is we consume 19 million barrels of gasoline a day. 10.2 of that is now for, I'm sorry, we consume 19 million barrels of crude oil a day in the United States. 10.2 of that is for gasoline. The other 9 is for other things. That's pre-pandemic. So we're back to gasoline demand pre-pandemic, and we're back to driving pre-pandemic. Production is not. Production around the world is around 90% of pre-pandemic. And it's getting harder to bring production back online. And December 8th is coming. We want to fire 15% of all the people that work in the oil fields because they didn't get vaxxed as well, too. So that's the mismatch that we have. We are back to driving like we used to, but we are not back to producing. And when I say we, I mean all the major oil producers, from Russia to Saudi Arabia to the United States to Canada, are all running at around 90% of pre-pandemic levels. That's why the price keeps going up. Easy way to get the price of oil down is let's all stop driving our cars.
Peter, you had a comment on that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, so what this does is it further disincentivizes drilling. And if prices go down, it further incentivizes demand for oil, which then ends up being an eventually higher barrel of crude oil once this SPR release washes through.
But
it's like cash for clunkers. It's like the home buying tax credit. It's all to give very short-term satisfaction, but eventually there's a payback to it.
So to put a finer point on what Peter just said, we're out of demand. We're out of balance. We are demanding more than we can produce. And by making attempts to lower the price, we get even more out of balance. And the only fix for that is even higher prices in the long term. The way we got to get back into balance is to produce more. But the problem with producing more is, yeah, we will in about 6 or 8 months. You can't produce more by, you know, a week from Friday. It takes a while to get that production cranked up again.
I talked to where I live here in Scottsdale, who's a wildcatter from Kansas, and he has proven how much he really knows his business. And he's told me over a year ago, the problem is there's not enough investment going into oil. Wall Street got killed in fracking. Regardless of whatever Cramer said, they took a beating in fracking, and they're not coming back so quick. So that money is just not flowing into the productive end, because as usual, you know, the oil patch seems to always take advantage of Wall Street. You know, they it takes them a while, and then they come rushing in, and then it's always too late, and they've wasted a lot of money. And he told me that's exactly what's going to happen. He was the same guy. The last time we had met up until recently was the April in 2020 when crude oil went negative, and everybody was asking him, how could oil go negative? And he pointed his finger at me and said, talk to Ira. It's a financial thing. It has nothing to do with what's going on. He says, I'm selling oil today at $6 down in Kansas. I can sell whatever I have for $6. It means nothing. So he's been pretty right. And I think that this is right, is that we have a lot of underinvestment, and the underinvestment is creating this, the shortage. And it's going to get worse in the oil, because what we're not talking about is what people's heating bills are going to look like this winter with natural gas prices as high as they are. And because a lot of natural gas now gets shipped out, which was never the case, but with LNG down through, especially through the Sabine Pass down in Houston, you know, down in Houston in the Gulf, that's getting exported. And there are energy companies, of course, who will now take to buying oil because they can't, the natural gas oil ratio is going to be out of sync, and they're going to be burning oil this winter for heating. And so there's not going to be any relief. So where the driving season may end, the heating season is going to be very interesting. And we are going to hear a lot of noise when people's heating bills start hitting the mailbox or online, to see, because that's going to be a 250% increase over last year. Forget what you're seeing at the pump. That's minimus. You know, what are you going to tell people? You know, we're going to go back to Jimmy Carter, put on three sweaters. I don't think so, especially because the White House politically is desperate to change the whole narrative of the headline. So this is going to be an interesting winter.
I have a question, a follow-up on that, on the oil and gas as the in trading, in terms of trading or investing, given that, you know, we have this situation, what is the better way to invest in terms of commodity prices or in energy firms or oil and gas firms, especially in light of equities of oil and gas companies that may be adversely hit by government NGO initiatives and regulations implementing agenda-based environmentalist policies, you know, attacking the fossil fuel industry or anti-fossil fuel activists. Just wondering your thoughts on that. Maybe begin with Jim.
Yeah, I know. I think, you know, if I had to play it, I'd probably play crude oil directly as opposed to playing the energy companies. Everything you said, I would throw in one other big problem that the energy companies face, and that's ESG. The problem, environmental, social, governmental, is the hot thing on Wall Street right now. Everybody wants the ESG label. Problem with the ESG label is it hasn't been thought through. All they've really come up with is E. So never, ever buy Exxon. Exxon could never, ever be a company that would qualify because of E and environmental. Conversely, I'll use Zoom. Zoom could never, ever not be okay in E because of the way that Zoom works. S&G, by the way, society and governmental, they haven't figured those out yet. Nobody ever talks about whether or not those two things work. So the problem with ESG investing, which is the hot thing, is it just means you can't buy oil companies. It's really all it boils down to. Couple of coal companies and maybe some internal combustion engine auto companies as well too. And so therefore it's shutting out a lot of investment. It's making it difficult to get those companies to their proper valuations as well too. By the way, speaking of auto companies and E and ESG, Ford came public in 1956. And every day from 1956 when Ford came public to last Wednesday, 1 week ago, the big three automakers in terms of market cap always included Ford, GM, and Chrysler. Usually it was all three were the three biggest auto companies in market cap, but it always included at least Ford, GM, and Chrysler. Last Wednesday, the three biggest domestic automakers in the United States were Tesla, Rivian, and Lucid, all electric vehicle makers. The big three are no longer the big three. The biggest one is GM, and they're coming in fourth place right now.
Your thoughts, Ira?
I have the ESG. Marianne's on here, so she has put together a corporation. But ESG, Jim is 100% right. They got the energy, the social and governance they're figuring out. And good luck with the governance, because having sat on a corporate board and immersed myself, and I know Crowley's here, immersed myself in governance issues and reading it, I'm sorry. It makes a grown man cry. My eyes glaze over. And then, of course, there's a team of lawyers to tell you how they're going to circumvent it anyway. So I'm always amazed when it comes to governance issues. And you know what? We have a president who kind of understands it, being from Delaware, which has been the bastion of corporate prostitution in this country for so many years. And they know how to circumvent everything through the Delaware Chancery Courts. Come on. You know, good luck. But Jim's right. They got the E. The E is easy. And there's a few people out there like Warren Buffett and a few others who are salivating because they've been able to pick up energy companies for very cheap, because there were many people who were spinning them off out of their portfolios because they didn't fit the current methodology of where they want to go to on the ESG. And of course, some have been labeled as greenwashers, that they really haven't made any change. So there are many people watching this. And as we just saw out of Glasgow, there are going to be many, many, many issues with this, but it's taken its toll on energy investing. We're already seeing it.
Interesting. And we have a question from Bruce Light. He has no mic, so I'll read his question. With the ECB lagging behind, almost contrary to the Fed's hawkish actions, in addition to RBA's actions, will the G7 be able to force the ECB to be more in line with the actions of the Fed? Jim?
Yes, I do think that they're going to be forced to. I think Ira mentioned it a little bit earlier. The dollar will go up, and it will go up, and it will go up and up and up and up, and it will force them to get in line. If they want to continue, the ECB wants to continue their PEP program, their pandemic emergency purchase plan, while the Fed is tapering and the dollar against the euro just soars and soars and soars, they might be forced to have to respond to an ultra weak euro along the line at some point as well too. So I don't think that I think that eventually they're going to be forced to be brought in line. Ultimately, with all central banks, we keep forgetting that when we look at the lineup of voters at all the central banks, there is another voter in every room, and it's called the market. And the market is a very powerful voice. And most of the time, the market is in agreement with all the human voters in the room. Now, it's at least in the U.S., it's a little bit out of sync. The market wants three rate hikes. The market, you know, the human voters and the Fed are not ready to go there. But the market will get its way. And so, yes, if that's what the market wants, it will get its way. The last example of that was, you know, Australia last month. You know, they had yield curve control at 10 basis points on their two-year note. And then the market broke and their two-year note went to 80 basis points. And Philip Lowe, the head of the Australian Reserve Bank of Australia, did his best John Lovitz impersonation. Yeah, that's what I wanted. I wanted that all along. Yeah, you know, no, I didn't lose control. That's what I wanted it to do and stuff. And so, and we agreed that we're going to end the program right now, exactly the way we thought it would do it as well. And that's what will happen with the market over and over again. It will break them and then they'll try and pretend like it was their plan all along and go along with what the market wants.
Great, Inara.
I agree with Jim. And I go back to the July ECB press conference, Christine Lagarde's press conference. And she said something there, and I had actually blogged about it because it was so out of the ordinary, because it was so honest. She maintained that they were going to be lower for longer, because even if they ended QE, the household and firms had taken on so much debt during these times of low interest rates that she viewed the market, the underlying market, especially the bank market, as fragile. And they had to be careful, because if they got too aggressive too fast, and she then it would really cause some instability in the system. And she said it again at the October meeting, and in a couple other people in the FT late last week and early this week were talking about it too, that you have to be careful because of the amount of debt. And it kind of brings a smile to my face, because they created this. And I know Peter, he'll smile too, but Yiddish is a great language. And there's a word in Yiddish, chutzpah. And when you really define chutzpah, it's that a 17-year-old boy killed his parents. And when he goes before the judge, he claims he asks for mercy because he's an orphan. That's what the ECB seems to me. We push this money on you. We push this on you. We cannot effectively change policy because now the system is too fragile because of the huge amount of debt. You just keep going round and round. So, Jim, they are going to do this. Bruce, it's a great question. They are going to have to do this because they can't. And the U.S. knows they can't go it alone, because the global financial system will buckle under the huge amount of dollar-denominated debt held out, you know, outside, because the dollar is a funding currency as well as a reserve currency. I don't know that we've really seen that totally, especially when Japanese rates were the only ones at zero and everybody was funding everything in yen bonds. But everybody, many people have been funding in dollars. So this is a very, this, to me, this is what weighs over the market. And I, you know, why there is no exit from this. They've created this monster and they're looking at each other going, huh? But they better, I agree with Jim, they have to sit down. They, listen, they've used the G7 before. It's time to use the G7. And if everybody does it together, it'll at least give some semblance of a beginning of a road to sanity. Right now, Christine Lagarde is making Jerome Powell and Janet Yellen's life very difficult, because she keeps pushing the euro and the ECB lower for longer in terms of rates. You know, she calls her forward guidance policy. So they need to talk a lot more than they're doing.
Can I throw a question out at Peter, if you're still there? The Bank of England, the unreliable boyfriend, promised to move rates, kind of hinted at moving rates, and then didn't move rates. Do you have any thoughts on what happened there and what's going on with the Bank of England?
So I know their furlough program ended September, and they claim that they wanted to see the subsequent jobs report, which we saw a September report just last week. But I think that's what they're claiming. I do think that they had so much egg on their face that they're going to have no choice but to hike in December. But That's what they claim. Now, to the ECB point, and I'll just say quickly and hand it back to you guys. Yesterday, the Bank of France head, Bill Roy, basically said the PEP program is definitely ending in March 2022.
Can I step in there for 1 second and add to that?
Sure.
I think the point you make is great, and I know Peter wrote about it. But I think that Bailey got cold feet, because he looked at the euro sterling cross, which is back down to 84, and last week was under. And I know Peter's been one of the few voices out there who's been bullish sterling against a basket. But last week we got down to 83 and change, 83. And where so many people have gotten Brexit wrong, meaning the economic impact of Brexit, was because the weakness of the sterling keeps Britain on a relative basis an attractive place. And I'm not even getting into the tax issues that will eventually that we'll eventually see. But the sterling on a historical basis is pretty cheap. Well, 83.17, that's on the euro sterling cross. 83.17 was the high of the euro sterling cross of the week of the Brexit vote. Brexit vote was on Thursday that week. So we're getting back down into that territory. And I think the Brits are very, very aware that they don't want that advantage that they have in Europe to dissipate. And I think that Bailey said, yeah, we don't have to be in any hurry here because again, the ECB is going the other way. And why are we going to be in a, I'm not in a race to raise it. Every, you know what, things are okay right now. And I, and where should we go back to? 76 on the cross? That would be, I think that would be very bad for Britain at this point in time. And if you, down the line, it won't be bad, but they're still trying to figure out how this is all going to work out. And they're still trying to figure out Northern Ireland. So I don't think they're in a hurry to have the pound appreciate against their main competition, which is in Europe.
And I have one last thought that it was unspoken, but I'm just guessing that maybe this is a factor, is that QE in England scheduled to end in December. It's been scheduled to end in December for a while. So by them having no QE and then on the cusp of raising interest rates, it's part of me that wanted to think that they were waiting to see what the Fed was going to announce a few weeks ago. That's just a guess.
No, I think that's a good point.
Okay, great. And how about a question from John Crowley, is a former partner with IRA at Sinclair & Co. John, do you have a question?
Thank you. I just had one issue that Ira and I have talked about a lot, and I think it's one of the best barometers of the effectiveness of Fed policy, and that is watching the velocity of money overall, MZM velocity. And of course, what's happened recently is that the St. Louis Fed has relinquished displaying any charts whatsoever. And the only charts I've been able to follow lately have been M1 and M2 velocity, which are continuing to sink. So, this disturbs me quite a bit as the Fed continues to expand its balance sheet, or did, yet it's had no impact on the velocity of funds, which I think is critical to their longer term policies. I'd throw that out to Ira and Jim to respond to if they wish.
Well, let me tell you what, there's somebody sitting in this room. I know she's muted, but she knows probably more about this than anybody I know here, Alexandra. But let me say this, and I know because I've been, John, I've been following, as many others have, is Lacey Hunt from the Hosington Group, and he's been all over this and thinking, right, you know, that's why he's not worried about inflation. Unless the Fed, as he says, goes from lender to spender, then he'll change his tune. But the velocity is really has him thinking that we are going into places that are going not to be inflationary at all, and that we're going to turn. But I would watch this. That reverse repo facility, where people go to because they have way too much, banks go to because they have way too much cash, and they exchange the cash for high quality liquid assets, treasury bills of short duration, because it's expensive for them to hold cash. You know, you got to pay the FDIC. You've got issues with holding cash, and there's, of course, there's nothing to be money. There's no money to be garnered from it. But if that were to start to shrink, meaning, you know, where you're over a trillion with the amount of every on a daily basis going into the reverse repo, if that were to start to shrink, I wonder if that would change the velocity of money, because it would be that banks would all of a sudden not looking to place the money at the Fed, but to actually start lending it. I mean, the only reason they go to the Fed is because there's nothing to do with it, right? They don't want to lend it. So I'm watching it. If we saw a dramatic drop, and I'm not talking due to the Treasury general account things that go on there, but if we started to see that, I would say, and then if you thought you had inflation, look out, because we're at these inflation numbers with this low velocity. So yes, we could say they're due to bottlenecks, but if it started to mean that banks were starting to get active and they saw potential to lend this money out, then I think these inflation numbers would grow fairly dramatically.
So let me throw out a different viewpoint. Dan Tarullo, who was at the Federal Reserve during the financial crisis, left in 2017. He went in October of 2017, and he gave a speech at the Brookings Institute. And he said that the Fed has no working theory on inflation. And the premise of the speech was, take whatever metric you want, including velocity of money, and go ahead and test it. And it all comes up to a zero correlation with actual inflation. And his point was, we don't know what causes inflation, and that's okay, but stop acting like we do. And so I would argue, I've seen the velocity of money numbers go down. We shouldn't have 6% inflation to begin with right now because of velocity numbers, but we do. And so therefore, I think that inflation is a much more complicated issue. The Fed's favorite theory is anchoring. You know, inflation remains well anchored. That's kind of an ass backward theory anyway, because how does inflation get unanchored? Does everybody wake up some Tuesday and say, now I'm worried about inflation, even though it doesn't exist? Or does it become unanchored because it goes up first, and then we become worried about it as well? I don't think they got the cause and the effect right. But so I think inflation is a much more complicated issue than just money and just velocity. And the last thing I'll mention about money, I don't think we know what money is. Hell, there's $3 trillion worth of digital made up money called the crypto space right now. In addition to unrealized gains in financial markets and everything else. Now, you could argue that means that the velocity is even lower, but over time, we've never known what the velocity of money is, because money is more of a concept than a hard thing to measure.
Interesting. And let's go to a question with Angelo Gallo of Lifelong Wealth Strategies. Angelo, do you have a question?
Hey, thanks, Richard. Yeah, Ira, this is not for you because I talk to you every day. This is for Jimmy and Peter. The last couple of, since you were talking about the velocity of money, the last couple of senior loan officer surveys that I looked at, credit card lending was picking up a little bit. Car loans had picked up. C&I loans were picking up a little bit. And then, Jimmy, you've probably seen the chart that was going around about G20 M2, global M2, over the last 20 months, right? Up $20 trillion. So I always used to think that inflation was a derivative of velocity of money. Clearly, it is not, and it is more complicated, as Jimmy says. But going back to the earlier discussion about this window whereby we seem to think that we'll have tapering ending, at least here in the U.S., and then, you know, certainly the two-year here in the U.S. is indicating some sort of a rate hike. I think, Jimmy, you said somewhere maybe around May. But when I look at that window of time and I look at the second quarter of next year, which is right smack in the middle of that window of time versus the second quarter of 21, whereby we had 12.3% rate of change growth accelerating, do you think that rates would potentially go down during that cyclical slowdown and causing the Fed potentially to reinstate QE again because there's a panic in the stock market or the equity markets?
So two things on that. One of the things that long rates, and Peter, I want to get your opinion on this too. One of the things that's got long rates going, not going up. Now, I know I've talked about short rates are at a 20-month high. The long rates are nowhere near a 20-month high. They were higher last month than they are right now. Might be that the market is discounting some kind of a slowdown and that terrible S word we're not allowed to say on Wall Street, which is stagflation. When all this stagflation means it's higher than average inflation and lower than average growth. And that might be where we're kind of headed right now. And so I think that long rates might be there. But to your other point, the Fed, as long as inflation is considered transitory, and according to the latest Bank of America Global Fund Manager survey, which was released last week, 61% of the hundreds of managers they surveyed said inflation is still transitory. That still seems to be the consensus view on Wall Street. If the Fed eases in a transitory inflation environment or no inflation environment, it helps both stocks and bonds. But if you get to persistent inflation, that's the game changer. Because then if you ease, you kill the bond market, you help the stock market. If you tighten, you help the bond market, you kill the stock market. And so when you get to persistent inflation, the Fed's got to make a decision which market dies, because we can't please both of them at the same time. If we can stay in this transitory inflation environment, then you could just pump and both stocks and bond prices rally. Or if you tighten, they both go down. But that's really why the inflation story is so important, because when we get there, it's the 80s. It's the 80s again. And that when you tighten, you're helping the bond market and you're hurting the stock market and vice versa. Peter, what about you? What's your thoughts on this?
Well, I want to say quickly on the velocity thing. I think one thing that is somewhat different with our economy now is so many companies are financed by either the capital markets or non-bank financing ways. And I don't think that's well captured within the banking system. You have all this private equity money that's financing business. Like I said, the capital markets through bond issuance or financing, and less is being done through C&I loans. So I think that's one of the reasons why velocity has collapsed more than you would think. To what Jim is saying, I agree 100%. I've been saying this recently that I think the Fed is going to reach a fork in the road. And that is when inflation is still running 3-4%, but the S&P 500 is down 20% in response to, let's just say, the end of QE and the beginning of rate hikes. And what does the Fed do? Do they try to save the S&P 500, or do they try to be Paul Volcker and try to further quell inflation? And that fork in the road is headed their way. So I agree with Jim.
Okay, great. And we also have Kevin McCarthy. Would you like to ask a question, Kevin?
You know, Ira, you were talking a while ago about central banks acting in unison with regard to tapering and so on.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I listen to you guys, which I have to say is very interesting, but very depressing, because I can't think of how these central banks are going to cooperate under these systemic pressures. I can't imagine that scenario. So I ask you, but I'll say that to everybody else here too. It seems to me that when I think about the general flow of the comments here, that you couple that with the lack of trust in institutions generally, I think we're in an environment where central banks will be more constrained politically than we've seen in a very long time. So that's my observation.
I think, Kevin, I think that's right. And Richard Clarida's speech last week was speaking to that, because, you know, everybody has different mandates, different tools in their toolbox. But my response back to him, and I was kind of surprised because he didn't talk about it, because well, you and I are both old enough, and Crowley, I'm not sure who else is at this table, but we know that we understand the Plaza Accord, 1998. And the one that I find really interesting was when the banks were in unison, was that Martin Luther King holiday. I forget which year it was, but it was maybe 05, 06, when SocGen with Jerome Curiel got into trouble. And then all of a sudden, the Fed cut like 75 basis points on that day or the next day because they were worried about the global financial system. So we've seen, and then we're following the Europeans because it was a European problem. And then, of course, the Brits before that had the Barings fiasco. So, I mean, we have seen moments in time where we have actually seen this. I think that if they're really paying attention, that they don't wait for the crisis and they go, look, we've gone this route. We just need to end tapering because they know it. It's not doing anything anyway because the money doesn't get lent. So what are you doing except digging yourself in deeper and deeper and creating more and more liquidity that if it does get lent, then you're really in a bind because you're going to have to raise rates far more aggressively. So I wait for them to do something proactively always rather than being reactive. So I agree with you. It's not an easy sell, but there's some real potential dynamite here.
A couple of quick thoughts. So Ira, it was January 20th, 2007 that SocGen blew up. And I remember it like yesterday because some things never change. I was watching Tom Brady lead the Patriots in the playoffs that weekend. And I guess I'm still watching Tom Brady lead the team in the playoffs as well, too. Nothing ever changes. Rich Clarida didn't get back to you either, Ira, because he's too busy doing some stock trades right now. He'll get back to you as soon as they settle as well, too. Let me say a nice thing about Fed central banks. I think that they have the right instinct. I have argued I had no problem with what Bernanke did in 2007 and 2008 for trying to deal with the financial crisis. The problem was he continued it till 2015 before he started raising rates. I had no problem with what Jerome Powell did in March of 2020. The problem is he's still doing it today as well. They oh, look, we did something right. Let's just do it now for another decade. And that's where they get themselves into trouble. They never think we got to get in. We got to stabilize the system, and then we got to get the hell out as fast as we can. No, they stick around for 6 years, 8 years. Greenspan did this after 9/11. He came in with an emergency funds rate after 9/11 and stuck around till 2004 before he started raising rates as well, too. I had no problem with what he did for the month or two after 9/11, but you didn't have to stick around till June of 04 before you started raising rates. So in essence, I think that they've got the right instinct in dealing with these problems. They just then hang around way, way too long with this policy, and it winds up becoming more of a problem than it was actually trying to fix in the first place.
I agree with that. I think that's exactly right. And that's why I said Bernanke's book needed to be named The Courage Not to Act, because I argued with Rick Santelli vehemently, when he went the route of the Tea Party. And I said, no, you need the QE1 was, and Rick would agree wholeheartedly today and many years ago, that QE1 was necessary to prevent the liquidation of the system, right? We're all back. I probably in the last 5 days, Kevin McCarthy and I talk about it all the time, but Andrew Mellon's comment of liquidate the farmers, liquidate the banks, that's not going to work. We know that that's not a, and that's what Bernanke did all his doctoral work on, is preventing that type of situation that happened in the 30s. You can't, if we would have liquidated in 2008 and 9, we would have gone to 20-25% unemployment again. The U.S. political system cannot tolerate 12% unemployment. It would have been an absolute disaster. But Jim, you're right. They just don't know when to quit. And then when Chuck Schumer made that famous comment back in 2012, when he said to Bernanke in Bernanke's testimony, "You're the only game in town." That wasn't a compliment. And I think he needed to stop then and let Congress, get into the do what they're supposed to be doing with this fiscal stimulus. But the bank took that away from them because they were so aggressive. And that allowed some conservatives in Washington to say, well, yeah, we got to hold the line because wrong. And I think the bank bears some of the responsibility. But I bring up Jerome Kerviel, which is kind of funny. I was reading through some nonsense that I usually read when I'm bored. He's the most indebted person in the world. He's in debt. Must have been with court filings. $5.4 billion he owes somebody. He is listed as the single most indebted person, probably close to Trump, but it's a one threat.
By the way, pro tip for you, Ira, if you're worth $5.4 billion or if you're worth minus $5.4 billion, you live the same lifestyle.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. And that means he'll probably get a bigger job somewhere. Anybody who can lose that much money, he's got to be, then he can make that much money.
Right. So the moral of the story is everybody's got to get nine figures after your net worth. And whether or not it's the plus or minus is kind of irrelevant.
Well, let me just say one follow up. Thank you for answering my question. But would it be fair to say that the tolerance for error in policy maneuvers going forward is much greater not nearly as great as it has been in the past?
What do you mean by the tolerance of error? I mean, I can interpret that a couple of ways.
Policy and you screw up and it starts to go the wrong way and you have falling out between various central banks and people going off in different directions and so forth. I mean, you can create your own scenario. But what I keep on thinking about is, and I hinted at this, you know, the acceptance of an economy that is not performing as well as it is right now. I just don't think people have any tolerance for it.
Oh, I agree.
With respect to central banks.
I'll give you an example of what you're referring to. December 19th, 2018, excuse me. Jay Powell gave a presser after the Fed announced that they were going to start to reduce the balance sheet by $60 billion a month. He referred to it as being on automatic pilot and like watching paint dry. The market interpreted that as it's never going to change, that you just announced that we are stuck reducing the balance sheet. It didn't like that. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 3% during the presser. It fell 3% and the market sold off hard until Christmas Eve. January 4th, Powell spoke at the American Economics Association meeting in Atlanta, and he came out and said, no, the Fed is now patient and flexible. So all it took was them to formulate a policy. The market rejected the policy for 4 days, had four bad days, went down about 9% in 4 days, right into Christmas Eve. Policy's out the window. Here's the new policy. We're not going to be patient. We're going to be flexible. We're going to give you whatever you want. There is no tolerance for anything. You come up with a policy, the market rejects it. You might as well change the policy at the press conference, at one point. And in July of 2019, when Powell was trying to talk about the policy change one more time, somebody literally asked him the question, Jay, you're talking about the policy of that might be perceived as a little bit more hawkish. The Dow Jones or the S&P sold off 1% at that point, 3% in December of 18. It sold off 1% during the press conference. And the reporter held his phone up and said, the market is down 1% since you started talking. Are you considering changing the policy? Right here in the press conference. 15 minutes later, because the market had a bad reaction to it. That's the kind of intolerance that we have to any kind of policy that the market doesn't like. All policy, to use a phrase from the crypto space, all policy is designed to make number go up. And that's all they want is number to go up. And if it doesn't go up, you better change the policy so number goes up.
Right.
Jim, that is such a great summation of it. And this is what always boggles my mind, why I'm always worried about central bank credibility. They've made such enormous bets on, as I say, tongue in cheek, on things that are not rocket science. But you'd think the way they make these bets that they're so certain. And yet Powell at the last press conference three times said, you know, we need to have more humility. Yes, you need to have more humility, but there's 8 trillion reasons that you've made an enormous bet about, well, that's not a lot of humility. That's like, let's do one and pull back. QE1, beautiful. Pull back. You stop the liquidation of assets. Let's see where this goes. Not, oh, all of a sudden QE2, that ends. Oh, let's go to QE3. And then, of course, everybody was talking about QE to infinity. But under Powell, and I think the most damning statement about what Powell did came out of Joseph Stiglitz last week, who wrote in supporting Brainard for the Fed chairmanship. He cited that what Powell in fact did, any sophomore in college would have known to do. I thought that's about as damning an insult as an academic could give you, to say that you're a sophomoric thinker at best. Wow. I would have asked for my money back and left, but it was pretty damning. But they made such big bets with such certainty. And you know what? I haven't seen the certainty. I don't know what they're so certain about, because as you say, during press conferences, they're forced to recoil. So I don't know.
Great. And just before we get to our last question, is there a question from area code 847? There's a caller that has dialed in. Sorry, didn't catch the name initially. Area code 847.
Yeah, it's Gidon Cohen. Yeah, thanks. So my question is, given the propensity that everybody's talking about of the Fed to just keep with this easy policy, what does actually catalyze them to change their views? Because it seems like all the pressures would otherwise create an incentive for them to just keep on kicking the ball down the road.
I think it's inflation. I think that as long as, and that's kind of a fancy way of saying markets, as long as they continue with this policy, they'll continue with the policy. They'll look at the markets. They'll be just like every retail investor, right? Well, this isn't a problem because the S&P's up. This policy is not a problem because the S&P's not selling off. Markets are holding together. When you get persistent inflation and the markets become unsettled by it, then they're going to be forced. So it's going to be an external event that's going to have to force them. They're not going to decide on their own that they have to come to this idea. And also, it needs to be that conflict of an external event. Give you an example. The Fed last year, 2020, was doing a program of purchasing corporate bond ETFs and corporate bonds, and spreads were narrowing. Then in November, the Treasury Department, without getting into the nitty-gritty, the Treasury had the final say on this program, decided, Steve Mnuchin said, we're going to end the program on December 31st. And the Fed pushed back and said, no, we can't end the bond buying program, but it's the Treasury's call, so I guess we have to. And then when January came, the corporate bond market didn't sell off. It didn't wobble. People said, well, maybe it's because it worked. It healed the market. And I said, or maybe everybody knows that in this environment, if the corporate bond market ever wobbled for more than 30 minutes, they'll come right back. They'll come right back and start buying like crazy. So in this environment, even if they pull back in a transitory inflation environment, everybody's okay with it because they know the minute that things get a little dicey, they'll come right back. But if they have to pull back because of a persistent inflation environment, they can't come back if things get dicey. And that's when I think that they're going to be forced to change and everything else. So it's going to be forced on them by financial markets. And I think the catalyst is if we get to a point where people think that inflation is persistent.
So do you think this is going to have 2022 is going to be the year? Because I've been thinking that this was going to happen for a long time and it just hasn't happened.
No, I think 2022 is going to be the year. I think that, you know, Peter said it right. Where we're going to find is, I believe we're going to see that inflation is persistent. Not that 6% inflation becomes 7 or 8, maybe it does in the next month or two, but when it settles down and settles out, there's lots of 3 and 4 handles out there, or maybe high 2 handles out there. And then that looks to be problematic, especially for people that own 160 or 168 right now is where it is, 10-year note bonds, 10-year note yields, excuse me. You know, if you're holding it at 168 and inflation settles out in high 2s, low 3s, some measures might even be closer to 4, you're not going to want to own bonds. And then those yields will start to, in market parlance, go to a 0 real yield, which is saying that they'll go to a 3 handle. And at that point, that's where I think it will come. So I think we're starting to see the persistent inflation already coming. Like I said earlier, the transitory crowd is already wrong. There is nobody in the spring that thought transitory meant we would see 4.5 core and 6 on headline by the end of the year. And in the spring, if you told them, no, we'll get that, then they would have said that that's not transitory. Well, I think we're at the end of the transitory. We're in the process of switching over. And when we do, that's when I think things will be forced on them.
Ira, any follow-on commentary?
No, I think Jim's is exactly right. And I'll just throw in one other thing, though. You know, we just saw the Social Security Administration delve out a 5.9% cost of living increase, right? And to me, I don't, whatever the Fed says inflation is, the reality of the situation is you have a government, an arm of the government, and I'm not arguing with whether the Social Security Administration was right or wrong about it, but it does say, well, wait a minute, here we have this is a real measure. This is not, as Jim talked about before with the Trulow, and this is a real measure of what is the pain out there. And more importantly, if Jim is right about 2022, and I think Edon's question is spot on and important, when the deficit funding rates start to go up and you are going to eat into discretionary spending in the budget, if you think you have political issues now, wait till that number, because everybody's quick to applaud. They pat themselves on the back. Well, this isn't so bad because the cost of funding the deficit is near, what, 40 or 50 year lows, even as it's exploding, because the average rate of payment is maybe 1%. So, you know, you're funding it at numbers far better than when, you know, the Volcker years or certainly in the 90s. When we, you know, had higher interest, when rates finally were out to rise, and the funding of the deficit became, you know, quite large. But then, of course, through the Clinton years, we did pay down a lot of debt. But right now, we're at low levels with these ultra low interest rates. But if we get to, you know, let's go back to, as Jim brings up, and it's important, the fourth quarter of 2018, when interest rates, I looked at in fact, I got it right in front of me. You know, the 5-year note in November of 2018 was 3.9% yield. Today, we're at 1.33. Imagine if you get back to those numbers and look at the damage that was done, right? We all remember the fourth quarter of 2018 Druckenmiller called the double shotgun, and what a great mistake it was. And Jim just summarized it and put it in perspective so beautifully. But if we get back there, and those are not historically high rates, 3.3% 5-year, really? And I always ask people this question: what do you think the effective real yield is on a 10-year note over the last 40 years? The effective real yield in the United States. 2.5%. Can you imagine this world that we live in with an effective real yield of 2.5%? I know a lot of people who will be in dire straits because I sit with people in their 80s who have 80% of their wealth invested in the stock market because there's no alternative. And you look at them and you go, take some off the table. I plead with them. Take some off the table. I'm showing you this is where you're overextended. They can't. They just, it's Pavlovian now. And it's, one thing I know is those things never end well. And we're talking about rates, 1.33 on a 5-year. It's not close to anything, you know, it's historically low. It's not anything historically high. And the Fed thinks, you know, Paul Volcker spoiled them because he solidified the great concept of, you know, it's an asymmetrical relationship. And my favorite economist, Joseph Schumpeter, who I'm in the middle of reading, by the way, I got a piece for all of you to read. But as he talked about pushing on a string, mm-hmm. and as Paul Volcker showed us, you can crush inflation out of the system by raising rates. Now, the central banks believe you can't get economic activity no matter how low you take rates, right? That's really the Bernanke basis to everything. And that's why they fear deflation. They don't fear inflation. The Fed, they do not fear inflation. They look at Japan, they fear deflation. Everything is prone to, and I'll, you know, we'll delve into the academic world again. Kevin, don't get mad at me, but Rogoff, in Rogoff's book with Carmen Reinhart, first of all, it should be Reinhart and Rogoff, not Rogoff and Reinhart. But they talk about that when you come out of situations like we had the great financial crisis, sometimes you need to run inflation 4-6% for a few years in order to alleviate the huge amount of overhang of debt. So this is kind of right in the academic world. We're not, you know, so you don't, I don't know what that number is. I don't think Peter knows what the number is. And I don't think we have a sense of what we know, but we don't know where they're going here. We really don't.
Hey, Ira, for your 80-year-old friend, Dogecoin. Just tell Dogecoin, you can't miss.
Okay. And you know what, though, Jim, when I tell them that, they look at me and laugh because they go, they've been right. Right? Every time the market closed up today, it was down 1.5%. They look at me like, you know, you're missing it. Yeah, but I'm still here.
Dogecoin.
No, I got a new one. Alchemy Pay. It's not a stock. You know that one, Marianne? You know Alchemy Pay out of Asia?
Please don't go there, Ira.
Oh, okay. I'll be quiet. Okay. Somebody just told me about it today, so I had never heard of it.
Hey, I have a question for you, Ira. You know that I'm an FX geek. How low is the Turkish lira going to go?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. That is a very dangerous thing on this horizon, both politically and economically, because Turkey, you know, Turkey is always vulnerable to a bad political situation. But the amount of money, you know, there's a huge amount of debt, dollar debt overhang. And if you look at Turkish borrowers who are borrowed up in dollars, their debt costs just went up 70% over this year. 70%. There's going to be a break point. I don't know what that break point is going to be, but I'll tell you who I'd be nervous. If I was living in the Kurdish provinces, I'd be very nervous because I don't know what's going to happen with Erdogan once push comes to shove, but I'm glad you brought that up. I don't know where it goes, but it was on a roller coaster today, as you pointed out. It's been on a roller coaster. There is nothing good happening there, and we better watch that because it's emblematic out of other. They don't have the political situations, but they do have the dollar issue. And if South Africa's experiencing it, you know, the South African rand's been fairly weak. So it's a good question, and I don't know, but I'm more worried about the political fallout.
I am too. Could be a nice geopolitical football.
Yeah.
And just a last question. Given the risks and trends economic perspective. We have discussed and covered what do you like in terms of trading or investment opportunities, like whether it's interest rate spreads, steepeners, equities, industry sectors, currencies, commodities, agriculture. Jim?
I think the inflation trade is a good trade to play. I'd play that one with higher rates. I still think commodity prices can continue to go up as well, too. The contrarian side of that trade is the banking system. I have not been a big fan of the current banking system. I know they've had a good year. I know that they've been a knee jerk because of higher rates. And I've just said that we're going to get even more higher rates. I'd stay away from the banking system for a host of reasons. I think regulatorily, they're going to have problems with Lael Brainard as vice chairman. They're going to have problems if Amarova becomes OCC. They're going to have problems from competition from the crypto space. Not everything in the crypto space is a mania on a meme coin. There is some legitimate projects going on there that will potentially be very disruptive for the banking system as well, too. Those would be kind of, higher rates, higher commodity prices, don't like the banks as well, too, would be kind of the three big themes that I would be pushing for in 2022. If we get persistent inflation worse than I think that the winner in that will actually be the crypto space. It is perceived as, I'm talking about the whole space, it's perceived as an alternative. And if you get persistent inflation, alternatives do very well. Gold should do well, but gold is frustrated the hell out of me because it should be doing well right now. And it hasn't been doing well for the last several months.
And Ira?
I'm not going to cite any individual, but I agree with it. Yeah, I think the real assets in the commodities, from agricultural to mining, I think will still do well until the central banks really slam on the brakes to halt global growth and then bring it down. And I just don't see that happening, because that's the worst of all worlds, and even when Lacey Hunt writes, if you go back and look, if you look at U.S. debt and global debt relative to when Volcker came into office and did what he had to do. And I'm not talking about that we're in that type of inflation environment, please. I'm not saying that at all, but they can't move whatsoever. And I think that they're going to again, tolerate higher inflation for longer. And if they keep trying to sell it as transitory, so be it. But I think that gives room to, a lot of really good natural resource companies. Of course, the problem with all the raw material businesses is that they're like telecoms. When they get a lot of money in their pocket, they tend to do stupid things. John Crowley's sitting there. He's the best gold stock analyst that I've ever known. He taught me that 42, 43 years ago. So he has seen it, and they make great mistakes because they get a lot of money in their pockets. So I think there'll be much better investments if they would actually declare special dividends and start getting rid of it rather than gorging themselves on it and making stupid mistakes. But I think those areas and, real businesses that are earning enough money to cover their, to pay dividends without incurring any more debt. Those are the things I'm looking at. And I think Jim is right. I don't own one U.S. bank now. I own a couple of European, and Jim, don't laugh, some Japanese banks that are like owning a bond because they pay their dividends, the two or three biggest ones, they go nowhere. It's dead money, except that when I put money in the bank, that's dead money too. So better to buy a bank than to put it in the bank. That's what I'll tell you, I'm looking at this play, and I know Yogi don't sell it. Commerzbank in Germany. I'm looking at this. It's so against the grain of everything I think. There's no dividends. There's no the stock has been absolutely dead money for so long. They've been trying to do the Deutsche Bank Commerzbank merger for a long time. But I stumbled onto a little nugget of fact that Cerberus owns 10% of them, and they're underwater by about $600 or $700 million now. And there's one thing I know about the American private equity people. They hate losing money. So they've recently laid off 10,000 people. And I think that what I had said earlier, that I think you're going to see Europe, because they've talked about it. Some of the researchers at the ECB have talked about going to a broker-dealer system in Europe, because the ECB is doing all the lifting here, and it's not really a good thing. And there's too many people, I think, who front-run them. So they have to figure out a different system. So if they go to that, I think Commerzbank, because everything that the Europeans have talked about is, if they go to a broker dealer, you're going to have to be domiciled in Europe. So that makes a terrible asset such as Commerzbank, which has performed so badly for decades. It'll be in somebody's crosshairs. So I'm looking at it. Again, it irritates me because I never buy a financial stock that doesn't pay a fairly decent dividend and can cover it fairly easily. That one sticks out of me, but yeah, you know, sometimes you have some house money, so I'm playing with it, but it is worth looking at for those reasons. And that's really about it. I'm pairing gains back here, you know, and these rallies into record highs. All my numbers show me there's a lot of exuberance. It'll go higher, but people say, well, why are you selling? I said, so if it goes another 10% higher, so what? This has been an unbelievable ride, and I'll get opportunities. And that's just the way that I think everybody sitting here that I know trades like that. You know, you don't have to squeeze the last penny out of everything.
Great. And Angelo has another question. Go ahead, Angelo.
Thanks. Jimmy, this is either for you or Peter or both of you. Retail sales have been firm, you know, here in the U.S. They're fine. When I look at the credit card processors, Visa, MasterCard, Fiserv, Global Payments, Jimmy, do you think they're suffering from, you know, DeFi in relation to crypto? Any thoughts on what might be going on in the credit card processing space?
I tweeted this out on Sunday. I think that this is exactly what's happening in the space. The payment companies are suffering bad. You know, you could throw, like you said, you know, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Cap One. You could throw Square. You mentioned Fiserv, Global Payments in there as well. So you could even throw MoneyGram. You could throw Western Union in there as a group. They're all terrible performers. And they seem to correlate very well with the amount of money locked in the DeFi space, with the growth of the with the growth of that space. They're disruptors that are getting disrupted right now. And I think that that's really, they're going to have to come up, all the fintech companies that work in payments are going to have to come up with an answer to what's happening in DeFi. By the way, Ira, if you want to signal that the payment system is done, Steve Mnuchin raised $2.5 billion from the Saudis to go into fintech and payments. So he's getting, you know, so there you go. That's definitely, you know, if there's a bell being rung in that space, that's it right there.
You hit my magic button, because I am such a not a Mnuchin fan. So were they able to fit all that money into his wife's Birkin purse?
I don't know, but you know what, when he's done deploying it into fintech and into the payment companies, whatever's left over, they'll be able to fit into her purse.
Marianne's off, but Marianne started a company called Ninth Gear, in which she's trying to disintermediate all the banks on settlement of spot currency transactions from 2 days down to literally a half an hour. That's what she's trying. So she would really be interested in this conversation. I've spent a lot of time with her because she found me via the FX side of the ledger. Somebody put her on to me. Very interesting. And that's exactly where we're looking. So good question, Angela.
Great. It's been an insightful discussion. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Jim?
Two things. You can check, the easiest way is to check out my Twitter feed at Bianco Research, or you can look me up on LinkedIn under my name, Jim Bianco. By the way, Richard, let me just point out, in 2 days, Thanksgiving, I want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving. Earlier today, the President of the United States gave a speech and said that the global supply chain problem is getting fixed. He then went on to say that there was fear that there wouldn't be enough turkeys for Thanksgiving, but don't worry, there's plenty of turkeys for Thanksgiving. So all of you that are going to enjoy your Chinese turkey that spent 18 months in a hot box going over the Pacific, happy Thanksgiving.
Okay. And Ira.
You know what? It was hard to follow that up. I love doing these. I get to sit with people like Jim Bianco and Peter Buchvar and others. This has been great. So I'm still writing notes from underground. And I go back and watch these all the time, or listen to the YouTube, on YouTube, the podcast, what we've done. And it's loaded we have a good time doing this while we're teaching, but these are such great educational tools that, Richard, you got to get these out there because they're really, I think, very important for people to listen to because they're not the mainstream thought. And we take you other places and give you some alternatives that are maybe not what you're going to see on paid TV where the commercials really create the content. So yeah, I love doing these. So Notes from Underground and these podcasts are great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And thank you very much, everybody.
And Jimmy, I'm going to send you an email right now about this essay that you have to dig up. And I'll send you the essay. I hope you'll be able to open it. I think I'll wait your response.
Okay. Thank you so much, everybody. Take care.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for joining.